You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The first thing to know about running for president in the 19th century is that you didn't run for president. You didn't go out and campaign. You didn't try to reach voters. You certainly couldn't be charismatic, and you didn't take the stump. For lower offices, yes, but for the presidency of the United States, it was seen as demeaning. But Stephen Douglas in 1860 had an issue. He didn't have any money, and he couldn't compete with his opponents, Breckinridge, Lincoln, and Bell. And he knew that he had an asset. Think about, we have the Patreon site, so the Patreon is simply the letters of my history can beat up your politics. It's patreon.com/MHCBUYP. Check it out. And if you can support the program, great. If not, you know, tell someone about the program, give us a review, tweet at me at myhist, at MYHIST. We have the Facebook group, Fans of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. And he knew that he had an asset. He was good on stage. He could whoop up the crowds and then the money would follow. Douglas starts hearing things. New England, despite generally being Republican, is a little weak this year. If he could reach Democrats there, he could awaken them and start a real campaign. On July 14th, 1860, he heads out. But you just can't call it your presidential tour in these times. The papers start nosing around, so his campaign manager and financier, August Belmont, tells everyone, the candidate is simply calling on his mother. His mother lived in upstate New York in Clifton Springs. And then he just wanted to go see his brother-in-law's graduation, which was in Massachusetts at Harvard. Oh, and since he was in Massachusetts, he just stopped for a visit to see his father's grave in Vermont. And along the way, if an audience talked him into speaking, or as Belmont said, betrayed him into a speech, how could he refuse? Needless to say, it was not convincing, and 19th Century Inc. demonstrated that the whole idea of not stumping was not simply candidates being demure, but enforced by culture and enforced by pushback. As one newspaper says, nobody was fooled by his contrivance. No other man in the Union would have the audacity to stump the country as a candidate for president, a Republican newspaper says. Seizing on Belmont's story that it was just Douglas going out to visit his mother all over New England, creative Republicans posted handbills that claimed to be looking for a boy lost. The missing child, a double hit on Douglas's shortness, has not yet reached his mother, who is very anxious about him. The boy, it says, in a final dig, is about 5 feet nothing. Noah Webster used a very similar device in 1795 to mock an up-and-comer in politics. In his America Minerva newspaper, he wrote the newspaper before he came up with his famous dictionary, he warned of a certain little senator running about the streets, whispering things in people's ears, and making large entertainments. Why, it's outrageous, meeting those voters, talking to them, buying them food and drink. That's what Aaron Burr, senator from New York, seemed to be doing, traveling around New York on behalf of Aaron Burr. Burr didn't like the pretense. He knew that his other opponents, they were running for governor too, but they weren't saying it. He didn't like the delegating of others, the political craft when he knew he was good at it himself, and he wanted to get the information that one gets on the campaign trail talking to voters. For Noah Webster, this couldn't be allowed, this running about the streets squeezing hands. It could make a somebody out of Mr. Nobody. Burr wasn't quite Mr. Nobody. He's the son of a respected clergyman. He's grandson to Jonathan Edwards, the famous preacher. He comes from a real family background that's known. He was a smart lawyer who leaped into politics when there was a faction going on in New York between George Clinton and his group and Robert Livingston and his group, and sort of fit very well without taking sides in that battle, and then each one maybe wanted to work with him, and lo and behold, he gets places. He ends up working on a campaign for Abraham Yates, political force out of Albany in the state, running against George Clinton. Doesn't win that race, ended up surprisingly working alongside Alexander Hamilton, one of the few times that'll happen. Loses that race, but George Clinton sees in Aaron Burr something, offers him the spot of state attorney general. He pursues it vigorously, and he's picked for Senate. Still, and this will continue through Burr's career, people can't quite find a solid principle that he's for, but he does pick up certain issues. He kind of knows when there's a good fight. He's known for campaigning against an unfair treaty with Great Britain called the Jay Treaty, after John Jay, who negotiated it, and just as much for defending the honor of immigrant and Republican. Okay, this would have been Jeffersonian Republican, small r Republican, Senator Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, who was elected to the Senate but then thrown out by the U.S. Senate because he was not born in the United States and not here long enough in their reckoning. He loses that battle, but in doing so gains the respect of Republicans. He loses that governor's race in New York to the author of that treaty, John Jay. He makes a commotion. He develops a reputation for his political prowess, but also for his intriguing. The Connecticut wits that write in various Federalist newspapers make up a poem about him. Democratiad. What mad ambition is in his bosom born. Nobody kind of knows what he's planning. So when during that governor's campaign, he takes off time to go to Virginia, which can't possibly help him win in a New York governor's race, many eyebrows are raised. He spent one day at Monticello with Jefferson. Neither man wrote or spoke of what was said. There's an odd reference that might be telling from Jefferson to a neighbor that makes it clear he was only there for the day, like he didn't stay over. But it's a pretty quick reference in a letter about something else. Federalists suspect that they were meeting to undermine the government, which, to Federalists, those supporters of the Washington administration, and at this time, 1795, meant trying to change the government at all, not having one of them lead it. Still, to the extent, 1795 would have been an intriguing year. People were pretty certain within the capital of Philadelphia that Washington was not going to run for another term and that there would be a novel thing in America, an actual contested presidential race. There hadn't really been, certainly not in 1788 when everyone knew Washington was going to win and most people knew that John Adams would be the vice president. In 1792, there's a little bit of a contest. Republicans actually try to replace John Adams with a figure from the Revolutionary War in New York State, George Clinton, kind of New York State local hero, you know, governor of the state, popular there, though also not without political enemies, George Clinton. And they were not able to upset John Adams. Burr volunteers, then he defers to George Clinton. That Washington was not going to run again was something that was not a surprise to people like John Adams or Abigail Adams, who were writing letters about it, waiting for when the announcement was going to be made. Washington constantly complained about the office. But in the rest of the country, it wasn't as well known. So the first campaign of 1796, you know, starts with a lot of quiet and secret intriguing, and then is very fast. It's often said that Burr and Jefferson run for vice president and president in 1796, are the ticket of the, quote, Republican Party. But this is very early in the Republic and the party system, and so I think there's more complexity to that. Some truth to it, but more complexity.
Jefferson was understood to be the presidential candidate. This is certainly sure. Of anyone who was anti-Jay Treaty, anti-Washington, anti-Hamilton, you know, anti kind of big government or national bank, these type of issues. James Madison leads the anti-administration forces in Congress, the anti-Jay Treaty forces in Congress, and he does conduct a meeting in Philadelphia, but it's not known what's said in that meeting. Burr's talked about in that meeting. Burr may have even received the highest number of votes in the meeting, but there are several other candidates talked about. Robert Livingston, also of New York, is one of them, who might run with Jefferson in this. A senator from New Hampshire is also talked about. Pierce Butler of South Carolina is talked about too, but he's the one that we know the meeting didn't go his way because he storms out. They didn't want to choose Pierce Butler because the group was looking for to run with the Virginian and the author of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson at this time would have been legendary. They want to run a Northerner. Federalist gossip is the only news of this meeting that survives. Southerners didn't like the idea of Jefferson Burr in 1796, not all of them. You can't really trust him. Is he really a Republican? You know, if we put Livingston in there, we know he's going to be with us. Burr's got a nice group behind him. And Burr did have this kind of organization in the New York that called it the Little Band that would support him in elections. And the clubs that he forms will be the essence of Tammany Hall, the political machine that's going to operate into the 20th century. Some of these Republicans at the meeting worry, if we run Jefferson and Burr, would Burr just run for president himself? He might start a Northern party of Republicans and keep the South down. But politics made Burr attractive, and letters seem to indicate, letters between the House clerk John Beckley and James Madison writing about this initially seem to indicate that it looks like Burr and Jefferson make the logical choice. Burr is a bit of a national figure for his stands. Because he defended Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, he's got friends there. And because he pushed for statehood in Tennessee, he's got friends there. He's got friends in Kentucky. But Burr would like to make more friends somewhere else. So once again, he puts himself into the race. He campaigns in Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Vermont. Doesn't call it a campaign, just says he's making some talks. This starts to get Republicans a little suspicious. John Beckley now writes to Madison that it appears that he's more dedicated to himself than anyone else. Like most things with Aaron Burr, it's hard to tell. The Federalist gossip, there's actually Hamilton has some spies that he sends up to hear some of these speeches that the little senator's making, and they say actually he's going out of his way to stump for Jefferson and not he. But Virginians are suspicious, and the Richmond Argus says essentially to vote for Virginia. Virginia's interests have to be represented in the election of 1796. It's a bigger state. It's a richer state. It's a better state. Burr will end up getting only one vote in Virginia. Was he betrayed by a party that had made him the vice presidential candidate? Jeffrey Palsy, in his The First Presidential Contest, 1796, and the Founding of American Democracy, suggests that there may have been no real presidential and vice presidential nominations or a deal at all in 1796. The caucus, if it recommended Burr, may have been no more effective than a backroom deal that many electors were free to disregard. And discipline was a very different thing then. This was a loose group of people. And for the Virginians, the interest of Virginia, that meant getting Jefferson elected president, was greater than anything else. As to Burr's 1795 visit to see Jefferson, Palsley writes, word was put out that no other politicians had been present during the visit. Burr had gotten the same Jefferson family dinner that hundreds of other travelers enjoyed. While the master of Monticello's capacity for secret transactions should never be underestimated, subsequent developments suggest that no clear-cut deal was reached. It's kind of reflected in this 1796 voting. Adams wins. Jefferson comes in second. It's 71 electoral votes to 68. Pinckney, the choice of Hamilton. Hamilton had a secret plan to get Pinckney and not Adams in there. It doesn't work. He gets 58. Burr is fourth, with 30 votes to Jefferson's 68. So there's 38 Republican voters, right, if we were thinking parties, that don't vote for him. Electors, I should say. Burr got nothing for his travels through New England. He doesn't get a single vote there. His votes come from Pennsylvania, a few from Kentucky. He gets Adams gets the votes from New York, so he doesn't get anything from his home state. He gets one vote from Virginia, as we mentioned. The Virginians decide, you know, if we vote for Burr, there's a possibility, who knows, you know, there's a possibility that he gets more vote. There's some deal with Federalists and he becomes president and not Jefferson. The best thing to do for Jefferson is to throw away your second votes. I should remind listeners that this is the time during elections before the 12th Amendment. So you don't pick president and vice president. The electors simply pick two people. But already people were thinking about who they wanted to be president and vice president. That really happens with election one. It's just you really can't control the dynamics. So you do the best you can. And the way that they do it in Virginia is to vote first for Jefferson, then throw away the second vote by voting for Samuel Adams. Now, this has a double whammy because it both protects Jefferson, because Samuel Adams isn't going to get a near enough votes to even be a contender. And it's also a little ding to John Adams by voting for his cousin. Did Burr feel deceived? He doesn't say too much about 1796 that's recorded. So, for instance, he doesn't also say that some deal was reached or he was the official vice presidential candidate or things like that. There's no letter like that. 4 years later, he does mention that he had no confidence in Virginians. They cannot be trusted. He will get on a more organized ticket in 1800 and will get all the votes of Republican electors, which is part of another story that you know well. And here I'm trying to shed light on the more obscure one, so there's no reason to get into the election of 1800, but you do know that that'll lead to a stalemate between Burr and Jefferson because there was such excellent party discipline. Some of that comes from what happened here. Burr was criticized for taking the stump, but he also benefited from it. By the time you get to 1800, George Clinton's health is not that great. And as one Republican elector said, Burr was the only man. His own efforts had put himself out there.
Let's go down to grassroots America where the people are hurting. And everybody's saying, why are we in this mess? First thing I'd like you to do, all of you, is look in the mirror. We're the owners of this country.
When billionaire businessman Ross Perot, Texan, offering a kind of refreshing change for many Americans.
We don't act like the owners. We act like white rabbits that get programmed by messages coming out of Washington. We own this place.
You have to go back to like May and June of 1992. First of all, the economy's in recession. President Bush is not that popular. At the same time, they did not run well-known names, Mario Cuomo, Sam Nunn. They have Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, who's kind of a new person who's winning most of the primaries. So a lot of people are turning to this guy, Perot, who's getting attention, and he's interviewed on the news quite often.
Can you give me a scenario in which you'd say, okay, I'm in?
Well, number one, I don't want to.
I know, but is there a scenario?
Number two, you know, if you're that serious, you, the people, are that serious, you register me in 50 states. And if you're not willing to organize and do that, then this is all just talk.
Stay with me, Larry.
I'm saying to the ordinary folks, if you're dead serious,
start
then
committees in
I want
Florida,
to see
Georgia.
Some sweat. I want to see some sweat. Why do I want to see some sweat? I said it earlier. I want you in the ring.
He decides he will run. He starts polling just as high in competition with the parties and one of the highest polling third-party presidential candidates since polling's been invented. But then just as quick, in July 1992, Perot gets out of the race. He actually decides to drop out of the race on the day before Bill Clinton's going to be nominated in New York by the Democrats. Now, This is probably on purpose. He was mostly running against Bush, did not like George Bush. Later, he explains the reason why. What annoyed him most was a secret plot to sabotage his daughter's wedding. "I can't prove any of it today," he says on CBS News, "but it was a risk I did not have to take, and a risk I would not take where my daughter is concerned." Perot says that President Bush's campaign was scheming to smear his daughter with a computer-altered photograph to disrupt her wedding. In addition to the accusations about his daughter, Perot said that he had a videotape of a senior member of the Bush campaign talking to a contract employee of the CIA in Dallas, and that the CIA employee was hired to tap into his computerized stock trading program to prevent him from having the money to revive his campaign. Marlon Fitzwater, who was Bush's press secretary, says it's all nonsense, nothing to it. I don't know where he's getting it from. These are fantastic stories. Bush family answers through Prescott Bush Jr., who says that Mr. Perot is a psychopath. After he withdraws from the race, Perot says that he's scheduled to meet with President Bush, but that meeting's canceled because Perot's saying too much about these dirty tricks. Eventually meets with James Baker, Bush chief of staff, campaign manager. Perot still tells papers months later that neither George Bush nor Jim Baker ever comes back and says, "You're crazy, we didn't do this." And I find that fascinating, Perot says. Years later, one of Perot's sources, he claims he has other sources, but one of Perot's sources was a man named Scott Barnes, who's a private investigator that sometimes would be used by Republicans, but also Perot knew, said it was a lie that he told Perot. Barnes said he and a former producer from the British Broadcasting Corporation, David Taylor, convinced Perot that his phones were being tapped and that Republicans had photos of one of his daughters in a compromising position and intended to disrupt her wedding. Barnes, who did occasional work for Perot, said he and Taylor thought a dirty tricks campaign linked to the GOP would cause George Bush to lose his presidency. But the plan backfired because Perot was drawn in, not realizing the whole thing was a conspiracy and a hoax. Although Perot and Barnes never met, they had spoken on the phone since the mid-1980s about their mutual obsession with American POWs and MIAs from Vietnam. Perot had become convinced that Washington had abandoned American POWs in the service of some CIA conspiracy. A former associate interviewed by Newsweek hypothesized that Barnes may have invented the story about a doctored photo in order to be a player in the election. If so, incredibly, it worked. Barnes claimed that he got calls from Jim Oberwetter, Texas chairman of Bush Quail, that Oberwetter began asking leading questions about Perot, including about the daughter. For his part, the chairman of the Texas Bush Quail campaign says that it was Barnes that contacted him, kept claiming that he had damaging information about Perot. So he's kind of like working on both sides. In one case, Oberwetter says that he hung up on Barnes. You know, Barnes' history goes way back. In 1983, Soldier of Fortune called Barnes its favorite flake. It was the greatest campaign that never happened.
The problems which this country now faces are staggering, both at home and abroad. We need the service, in the great sense, of every educated man or woman to find 10 million jobs in the next 2.5 years, to govern our relations, a country which lived in isolation for 150 years and is now suddenly the leader of the free world, to govern our relations with over 100 countries, to govern those relations with success, so that the balance of power remains strong on the side of freedom, to make it possible for Americans of all different races and creeds to live together in harmony, to make it possible for a world to exist in diversity and freedom. All this requires the best of all of us.
It would feature two opponents of opposite political philosophies, not just parties.
Let our republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile by unthinking and stupid labels.
With differences and debates between them on television for the whole country to see, liberal versus conservative, every argument. But an assassin's bullet would change it. It's easy to forget that Kennedy's 1963 trip to Dallas, where he was assassinated, was a political trip mending fences between the liberal and conservative wings of the Texas Democratic Party, including his own vice president and a liberal senator, Ralph Yarborough, didn't see eye to eye. Kennedy makes them ride in the car together. Texas was touchy, touch and go for the Kennedy campaign planned for 1964. And Kennedy wanted to win the state. It was also trickier 64 was going to get because George Wallace was announcing that he would challenge Kennedy in primaries in 64, not just in the South, but also in the North. And this was before any civil rights bill had been passed. It was just when Kennedy had spoken out for civil rights on TV. On November 13th, 1963, Kennedy has a planning meeting. This could be fun, he says, if it's Barry. He liked Barry Goldwater, but he said Goldwater had no brains and could be beaten. So he recommended to DNC chair John Bailey that don't waste it if we see a chance to praise him. The president was picking his opponent. He wanted Goldwater to run against a novel strategy that on reflection might have long legs. Give me Barry, JFK said. I won't even have to leave the Oval Office. The two had already had conversations, Senator Goldwater and the president, and they would plan a series of TV debates just as Richard Nixon and Kennedy had debated on TV. Goldwater would end up getting no debates against Lyndon Johnson in 64. But Kennedy also had another opponent for his planned 1964 campaign, poverty. He had announced a program to help Appalachia, the poorest region of the nation, but he wanted to go national. His visitors also found their target for Kennedy's re-election win, the suburbs. It's 64. Voters were moving out of the city. Catholic voters who supported Kennedy were concerned now not only with city issues, but also with property taxes and storm drains. Kennedy would aim his campaign at the suburbs.
A future in which our country will match its military strength with our moral restraint, its wealth with our wisdom, its power with our purpose. I look forward to an America which will not be afraid of grace and beauty, which will protect the beauty of our natural environment, which will preserve the great old American houses and squares and parks of our national past, and which will build handsome and balanced cities for our future. I look forward to an America which will reward achievement in the arts as we reward achievement in business.
James Reston wrote about the upcoming election. Kennedy's been lucky in his competition. His record would not be an issue if he ran against Goldwater, who is too conservative. Sadly, it would be Lyndon Johnson, not Kennedy, that would run.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The corporate world is like the ocean. It's alluring, but it's also full of deadly creatures that can shred you to pieces.
It becomes kind of like a Game of Thrones political arena where everyone's trying to murder you to get your job or your title.
As former corporate executives, we know firsthand that navigating corporate waters is not easy.
My family doesn't come from corporate background, so I didn't have any sort of guidance in that.
I wish people would be able to understand in this corporate world that talking about things that don't work or identifying problems does not mean you're a problem.
We'll dive deep into what happens behind fancy corporate doors or Zoom backgrounds or whatever.
Are they really performance improvement plans or just a legal tool to get rid of people? I know a lot of people have been saved because of them.
We've created the show to help you navigate tricky corporate situations based on research and real-life experience.
I have really good advice. Don't go to a strip club with your team.
Listen to the Ambi Award-nominated podcast, Surfing Corporate.
For Abraham Lincoln, his honest thoughts were that he was in trouble when he was up for re-election. I mean, no polls were taken then. 1864 was a bitter year, country in the middle of a civil war. Good deal of concern about that war, not everything going well. Abraham Dittenhofer was a young man then who had moved from the South to the North and rejected slavery. He wrote in his memoir in 1916 about helping out the election of Lincoln. The renomination of Lincoln was not accomplished with ease. But if Mr. Lincoln's doubts about his renomination had been serious, his fear of defeat at the polls had developed into a veritable mental panic. Lincoln writes a note. Before the Democrats have their convention, where it's likely that they're going to nominate his former general, Lincoln has his secretary John Nickley show a note that he's written to every cabinet member and get every cabinet member to read it and sign the back of it. The note says, "This morning, as for some days, it seems improbable that the administration will be reelected. So he and the cabinet will operate with the president-elect during that period to save the Union during that time, as he will have secured his election on grounds that will make it impossible afterwards." It then goes into the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles' safe. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because he has a safe. But why write this letter? Maybe it's to bind him and his cabinet against any inclination to do something different if there's an emotional reaction to the election, to make sure that the cabinet members are all on board and that the future policy of the administration is clear, even if there's going to be some senioritis as cabinet members know they're leaving. I could think of reasons like that. I mean, Lincoln has analyzed, he's overanalyzed, there's so many books. And yeah, it's refreshing to read something new about him, like Dittenhofer's working with Lincoln. He works with him in his 30s. I read into Lincoln's modern celebrated melancholy. I also read into this a dig at his opponents, because if you notice, he's not just saying I'm going to lose the election, though he thinks that's true. He's also saying I'm going to lose my election because this guy's going to run in a way that's just giving up to the other side that we're at war against. Now, a little bit of a dig there, too. Here's what Dittenhofer says. In the interval between the Republican convention in June and the gathering of Democrats in August, the progress of federal arms had not reached expectations. Grant had not taken Richmond. Sherman had not administered a decisive blow to General Johnson. But Dittenhofer said the Democrats also blunder, too. After Lincoln writes this letter, when they meet in Chicago, they call the war a failure, and they call for an immediate cessation of hostilities. This, and the party picks Congressman George Pendleton of Ohio, a noted copperhead, like a Democrat who is sympathetic at least towards the Confederate cause and wants to end the war. They pick him as his vice presidential candidate. They do nominate George McClellan. Lincoln feared that choice. He knew that McClellan would be a strong political pick. Despite everything we hear about McClellan now, you got to remember, we're just hearing the bad things because so many books have been written about the Civil War and we celebrate Grant. But Grant is still a new figure, if a popular figure at this time. McClellan was extremely popular. He's going to be, in the future, governor of New Jersey. And his son, who's not born yet, is going to end up being mayor of New York. And a big reason for that is the McClellan name. So he's not an unpopular person. I think it's important to remember. Despite his failure as a general, he still had soldiers that respected him. And indeed, McClellan takes an interesting action that you have to look at as probably the high point for the opposition to Lincoln in the 1864 election. He accepts the nomination, and of course, like any good 19th century candidate, you have to go overboard. This nomination comes to me unsought. I'm sure no one at all talked to him about it. But he does insist that he's actually going to bring his own position to this nomination. The Union must be preserved. I could not look at my gallant soldiers and tell them that their sacrifice was in vain. I would hail peace with joy, but no peace without union. This is different from the Chicago platform. A lot of times when you see this in history, and I probably even said it on the podcast talking about 1864 at different times, you'll hear it said, McClellan repudiated the Chicago platform. But did he? That's an open question. He certainly changes the requirement for ending the war, requiring union. So he's not going to allow secession, which the Democratic platform in Chicago doesn't. And that's a pretty big step. But that's about all he does. He doesn't say, I repudiate this platform. He doesn't use that word at all. Here's what Republican-friendly newspapers say. They pour water on that concept. You have a party demanding cessation of hostilities, and he's taking that nomination. It's like the bridegroom taking the property, but not the person in marriage. James Blaine, remember him? He calls McClellan the only military man to campaign on the basis of capitulation. Dieterhoff is one of these people out on the trail, and he speaks at parades. He calls McClellan the leader of Confederate forces. He says he's a delayer, not a fighting general. It's a common attack. He wasn't really leading the forces to victory. Dieterhoff points to the Confederate newspapers being overjoyed when they hear of McClellan's nomination. Prices of Confederate bonds, he says, are rising on the prospect. The same is relayed by a soldier in the trenches, Sergeant Samuel Chase, a Pennsylvania soldier, who hears as the soldiers are voting out loud to the clerk, and they're close in the trenches to the other side. And when someone would say McClellan, the Confederates would shout, huzzah! And that, Samuel Chase says, that's when I knew to vote for Lincoln. Colonel Charles Wainwright, who had been critical of the Lincoln administration, their conduct of the war, the proclamation, he was ready to vote against him. If the Democrats would put a strong war resolution and keep the Vallandigham sorts out, nominate good men, Vallandigham was even more than Pendleton, a blatant copperhead who would end up getting thrown out of the country and sent to Canada at one point. First sent to the Confederate. He's so rabid a copperhead in speaking out for with sympathy for the Confederates and the cause and against the Union war effort that Lincoln actually has him turned over to Confederate lines, except Confederates don't really want him either, and he doesn't really want to be there. He does end up going to Richmond, but ends up in Canada and then eventually back to Ohio. But when he hears, when this soldier Wainwright hears about the Chicago platform, he knows they haven't done that. They haven't ridden the Vallandigham sorts out of their party. I cannot chew that platform. I cannot vote for a man that says the South cannot be conquered. After enduring privation and difficulties that none but the soldier can imagine, I cannot swallow it. These are just a few examples from the story of the 1864 election, which is partially a story of civilians voting. Of course, that's the larger vote, and then a story of soldiers voting. Lincoln gets a majority, even a supermajority, of the soldier vote. At least, you know, that's the way it's told. It's told sometimes 80% or 70 or so percent of the soldier vote he gets in his reelection. And it's true to an extent. The collected, recorded votes that we know, 155,000 some odd soldiers vote, and McClellan, to estimates, gets only 34,000 of them. However, historian Ian Toll looked into this soldier voting more, and just want to look at some of his points. Let's say there's soldiers who didn't vote at all. All right. It's not all this overwhelming mandate. There's soldiers who voted for McClellan, not many, as we see. There's soldiers who vote for local tickets only that don't vote for either man for president. James O'Neill of the 4th Delaware, for example, is one of these. Lincoln wanted to prolong war to abolish slavery. McClellan was totally opposed to the interest of the soldier. He votes for local tickets only. At least 20% of soldiers, Toll said, did not cast a vote for president. Also, it's not always a fair vote in the military. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton would dismiss soldiers he heard of who spoke out against Lincoln. Some soldiers who had stopped, who had supported McClellan were court-martialed. Soldiers in West Point go to a McClellan meeting in fall 1864. When they come back, they are ordered to dig a drain for the superintendent's toilet. But Republican soldiers who are going to a Lincoln meeting are totally permitted to go to the rallies. There are examples of furloughs being granted only for soldiers who would go vote for Lincoln. And that's another thing. Not all states allowed soldier voting. So you are some soldiers did go back to their states and vote, and it's not well recorded in these voting numbers that we hear where, oh, Lincoln won 70%. It's not clear about soldiers who went back to their states and were just in those precincts in states, you know, just in the totals with all the civilians. But soldier voting was important. It sets the precedent for the black former soldiers. 200,000 black citizens fought in a war, earned their rights, and it set the precedent for procedures of all people voting, and it sets the case for the 15th Amendment and sets the case for absentee voting. As true or not about the soldiers saving Lincoln were, the fact is the victory in Atlanta does. Dieterhofer is an elector in Albany, and he casts an 1864 electoral vote for Lincoln. McClellan, after the Union victories, would earn just 21 votes, the lowest total of any candidate until Taft. When he first met Lincoln, Dieterhofer said, "Typically Western he seemed to me in his face, his figure, his dress. How would he bear himself if called upon to leave the Republic, I thought. At the early time, no suspicion of greatness came to my mind. Those thoughts were wrong. As a statesman and a reformer, he belongs not to America, but to the world." That was a man 70 years later thinking about Lincoln in the election of 1864. No one can discount the double accomplishment of 1864. I mean, the U.S. had an election during a war, so this could not be questioned anymore. And they chose, I think, at least the right person. Most observers do. It's possible McClellan, you know, could be this story. Like, you have the story of Chester Arthur, right, against civil service reform, and then for it when he gets into the presidency. Maybe McClellan gets into the presidency, and as he sort of hints he might do with his acceptance, does something different, prosecutes the war. It's going to be tough because the first story of an administration hypothetically like that is going to be a story of him fighting with his own party at every step. In the end, though, it's right to say that Lincoln was right. If the election had been canceled, it would have ruined us. In terms of soldier voting, states paved the way. Ohio in 1864 allowed Ohioans in faraway Atlanta to vote in their camps there, dropping ballots into boxes and having the vote go to proxy votes that could be mailed to the state. Pennsylvania sent state officials to the front to oversee this process. A couple other states do too. 12% of Ohioans were soldiers. 12% of Ohioan voters were soldiers. The majority were for Lincoln. Pennsylvania, too, has precedent. It had passed a Military Absentee Act in 1813 to allow for War of 1812 militia to vote if a soldier was more than 2 miles away from a polling place. But to prevent fraud, Pennsylvania's constitution amended later to forbid anyone voting anywhere but the election district that they reside in. The legislature adjusted the Military Absent Act to allow for soldiers, but that's a law, and the restriction was constitutional. So this issue comes to play in 1861 as Pennsylvania Supreme Court actually rules soldier voting unconstitutional. Pennsylvania, before the 1864 election, has to amend its constitution, but it does so to override that court decision and allow soldiers to vote so that they can in the 1864 election. Connecticut, seeing what happened in Pennsylvania, sends its absentee ballots bill to the Supreme Court of Connecticut, asks them to find it either constitutional or unconstitutional. before they enact this bill and have to wait for a case. The Supreme Court does review it and says it's unconstitutional. And then Connecticut amends its constitution. So does Kansas. So does Maine. So does New York. So does Rhode Island. In Indiana and Massachusetts, they try to amend the constitution. But the amendment fails. So soldiers had to get furloughed or come home or not vote.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
Oliver Morton, Republican governor of Indiana, one of these states that, you know, didn't always see a lot of soldier voting because the Indianans in the service were away. He always felt that with Republican soldiers away, he ended up with a Democratic legislature opposed to war measures. New Jersey also failed to amend its constitution to allow absentee voting, though it did after the war. One noticeable effect of soldier voting was in Maryland. An amendment to ban slavery in the state passed by 475 votes. That means it is indeed the result of soldier votes. Without being counted, they would not have been decisive. As for civilian absentee laws, it starts in the 19th century with soldier voting, the idea of any kind of voting out of your, when you're not physically in your election district. Civilian absentee laws are rooted in these military laws. You see it in the 19-teens. Vermont and Kansas have very limited laws. A voter can vote somewhere else, but it has to be Vermont or Kansas in a polling place, and they have to fill out a form. It could be challenged. If it's like one vote between the election and it's yours, that might be challenged. Missouri and North Dakota enact civilian absentee laws. During World War I, you see some states updating and using their soldier vote laws to apply them to supportive industries, people in railroad jobs, or university students. World War I leads to an increase in absentee legislation. Only three states don't have it by the time you get to 1924. But it's rooted in the disruption of war. In World War II, there is an official federal war ballot, a bright red envelope mailed to the Secretary of State by the soldier serving anywhere. But it's only enacted before the 1944 presidential election after there were problems. In the first years, you know, 1942, 1943, and soldiers are writing letters telling them they were tired of Congress stalling legislation and their state stalling legislation for soldier voting. It had no names on it. The soldier had to write in votes for president, U.S. senator, and Congress. It was only for U.S. elections, not for state elections. California, Florida, Georgia, Maine, and 22 other states allowed the use of these ballots. 11 million individuals serving around the globe could potentially benefit from this program. Without polling and with very biased media in those times, newspapers were either calling Lincoln a black Republican or a saint. You couldn't quite tell what was going on, where the races were turning. And 128 years later, candidate would find himself the netherworld of an attack caused by his opponents. And the attack was, he was crazy. Maybe he made a visit to a psychiatrist. A neighbor of his wife's sister. The candidate is Michael Dukakis. His wife, Kitty Dukakis, had that psychiatrist friend. The Boston Globe reported that Dukakis didn't release his medical records. And then Dukakis refuses to when asked. The campaign in 1988 just releases like a quick letter about Dukakis' health. No major problems. Here's how the Washington Post describes what happens next with this little bit of fact stretched out. What happened next was a phenomenon peculiar to the insider's political community. Obsession with a question that's unknown to the rest of America. And there's this talk among the campaigns and among the reporters that follow the campaigns, the gaggle, that the Detroit News is about to release a Dukakis story. It's gonna release it. And of course, the person behind that is Lee Atwater. He even says within the Bush campaign and to some reporters, he's about 20% sure this Detroit News story is going to be true. And it's enough to kind of get the whispering going. And it's this weird mixture of if you try to challenge Lee Atwater on it, well, he didn't really say it publicly. He just kind of whispered it. He also said it's probably not true. And also he's citing the Detroit News as the source. So giving it this little like air of credibility when really it's just coming from him. Then you get to the White House press conference and no one's quite sure what happened here with this one. But a reporter asks Reagan, and maybe Reagan was viewing the newspapers or maybe Reagan had heard some of this talk in the White House. You know, Reagan is involved with the 1988 campaign, but Bush does have a separate operation for his campaign. President Reagan, asked by a reporter, probably upset that Mike Dukakis had attacked him and his administration, says that, well, Dukakis is an invalid. The reporters are shocked. I mean, there's no basis for this whatsoever. He ends up, Reagan, having to sort of apologize. He doesn't really apologize. He says it was a joke. Dukakis, running a kind of calm, take it easy campaign. We talked about this in the episode about Kennedy and debates we had earlier on in the fall. And, you know, the last thing an opposition party who's running against an opponent who's not the incumbent president, but there's an incumbent president in office who's popular. You don't want to wake the dragon, so to speak. So I think they didn't want a Dukakis versus Reagan. They wanted to keep it versus Bush. So Dukakis tones it down. He basically says, we all make mistakes. Maybe he's going to give himself a freebie if Dukakis makes a mistake down the line. The president doesn't need to apologize. So no apologize was given and none was accepted, but none was also needed is how this story goes. So the president has just called the opposition party candidate crazy. It does force Dukakis to go ahead and release a lengthier report from his doctor, which says, of course, he's not crazy. He doesn't have any major health problems. And eventually that Detroit news story does come out. And there's nothing about him at all, except just repeating that he hadn't released the medical records when asked. This non-story becomes a real event. In fact, Dukakis thinks that it was responsible for at least an eight-point drop in polls. You don't lose 8 points in a week for nothing, he would say later about this. And it leads to an Evans and Novak, just kind of like the second day story of all the Democrats are saying he's not handling this well. You know, this shouldn't have gotten as far as it did. The Orlando Sentinel joked about the phantom psychiatrist trailing as badly as they are. And at this time, the Bush campaign was trailing. All they have are negatives. Atwater had done this in the past to a political opponent. So the Sentinel pointed that out. Tom Turnipseed in South Carolina created just this unfounded shock therapy story that had no basis in anything other than maybe somebody was remembering about the Eagleton crisis in 1972 with McGovern's running mate. And so out of thin air, this stuff comes in. Medical records would be an issue, surprisingly, for Bill Clinton as president running for his re-election in 1996. He's running against a 73-year-old opponent, Bob Dole, and he's 50. I mean, you would think that Dole would be the one with a medical issue in the campaign, but Dole, because of his age, did release his records and a report. He saw that coming. And then he said, well, now it's Clinton's turn. Dole's campaign asks, why won't the president of the United States provide a full accounting of his medical history and records? The Dole campaign says, partial disclosure is no disclosure, as the Clinton's White House has proven time and again. And Dole goes on 60 Minutes and asks for it after Clinton won't release more. I've released mine. Why hasn't he released his? They weren't worried about Clinton's physical strength, of course. What they were hoping is to get the topic on, is Clinton using drugs? Clinton stuck to the White House physician letter that had already been released, and it didn't become a huge issue. He won the race. These unsettling rumors that end up in campaigns, though obviously promoted by one side, do have a long history. I mean, perhaps it's because Americans are skeptical of politicians anyway, or perhaps it's because the press wants to scoop or wants to make the campaign more exciting for readers. I could see newspaper reporters saying, I have no idea if Dukakis is crazy, but what if he is? And what if the New York Times confirms it before me? No more than speculation. But it does. But there is the possibility that maybe Atwater sent it out into the rumorverse in the hope that reporters might land not on Mike Dukakis, but on Kitty Dukakis and her well-known alcohol problems, which she disclosed during the campaign, but actually continued long after the election of 88. It's not known. Susan Estrich, Dukakis' campaign manager, wrote in 2004 that when she saw some of the John Kerry Swift boat attacks coming, people who had said they served with John Kerry but weren't actually serving with John Kerry, she said, I've seen this movie before. Allegations come out, you don't respond, and we see how it goes. Of course, there's some of that that went Bush's way. The very common assertions of cocaine use about George W. Bush made all the time, various websites. The Larry Flint talk of an abortion Bush had for a girlfriend in the early 1970s, that, and saying constantly that he knew the girl, could prove it. He managed to get on a few seconds on the end of Crossfire, CNN, about it, unchallenged. I knew the girl, I can prove it, but doesn't. These didn't stick as well as Swiftboat. Now, Dan Rather's presentation of the Killian documents is another example, where documents were allegedly made from Bush's commander in the Texas Air National Guard. The documents' authenticity were in question. It turns out some of the CBS's own sources were not really as ironclad in approving those documents. And some of them say that doesn't really look like. These kind of zeitgeist rumors aren't new at all. Just confirming things that you already know, or pretending to have confirmation of what you already know. When Andrew Jackson, now president in 1832, is getting into his re-election, at the same time, he's operated on to finally have a bullet removed from his shoulder, one that he received from Senator Thomas Hart Benton in a duel. It was a field day for his opponents. The duel was in 1813. This is 1832. Yet, for the Whig press, this was an indication. And you know, as they're running Henry Clay against him, it was just an indication of how disgusting this man was. He was a brawler. And now the president is in a sling. And again, it's like the sling is a fact. He's walking around with a sling. Anyone in Washington City is going to see that. And that he was a dueler is also a fact. But combining those two things to take an 1813 duel and turn it into an 1832 president, still a very brawling man, is the magic of the opposition press. A Jackson supporter did the natural thing, Oppo research, and found a story about his opponent, Henry Clay, who also got into duels. And at one time, he was hurt so badly in a duel that he had to be taken to a friend's house. The Jackson supporter wrote, He was treated with tenderness and courtesy by his friend and his friend's wife and family. But what did Henry Clay do while recuperating? He plays cards, and he ends up winning a large sum of money from his kind host. Maybe Jackson is a brawler, but Clay is a gambler, an ingrate, and still a brawler. I want to thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed these. If you stayed with me, well, I thank you a lot. You are a superior listener to My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Think about, we have the Patreon site. So the Patreon is simply the letters of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. It's patreon.com/MHCBUYP.